Welcome to Shorties, a short true crime story.
It's an exciting day.
It is an exciting day. It's Monday, October 3rd.
Mm-hmm. First day of our season.
Yeah, but didn't you watch Mean Girls?
Oh my God! It's October 3rd. I was gonna say the day that she talked to Aaron Samuels. Yeah. Oh, I feel like I failed as a female there.
Yeah, I feel like you did.
That's
too.
That's gross. I know. The whole mood just shifted in the room. I was like, "Yeah, we wear pink that day." And I'm like, "No, that's Wednesdays." Idiot.
Hi, I've missed you.
I missed you too, roommate.
Well, I mean, like, I've missed this.
Yeah,
no, I've missed doing this in a long time.
And it feels so, if you listen to our little life update, it feels so good to be able to sit down and actually feel like happy and energized and like exponentially better than when we recorded that.
Yeah.
That itself just feels like such a win. And I'm just so excited to do this with you.
Yeah. Even since then, we recorded that on my birthday. So that was September 16th and it's October 3rd.
Yeah.
You have improved so much more since then.
Yeah.
So things are looking up.
Things are looking up, and I'm just, like I said, so excited to be doing this.
Yeah. And we want to say thank you to our listeners who have really stuck by our side.
I know. we see you and we appreciate you.
Yeah. And we went away.
It never goes unnoticed though. Like we hope that you know that.
Yeah.
What story do you have for me today?
I have an interesting story. Nobody technically dies.
Okay. That's always fun.
I felt like that. It's always fun.
It's a fun
So surprise. I felt like that was a good way to start off. It's kind of I'll just get into it. I don't want to spoil it. So
okay.
Should we just do it?
I feel like you just begin telling it to us.
I should just begin?
Mm-hmm.
I'll begin. Then here we are. I'll begin.
Beginning.
we're beginning. Also, I don't really know how well I'm going to do this. I didn't read through this very thoroughly. And I feel like whenever we come back from a huge break where we haven't done this in a long time,
We get rusty.
It gets rusty. We stumble over our words so much. Suddenly we have like a lisp or we don't know how to read. Or something. Or we forget words and reading and all sorts of things.
We're all human.
So the story today is full of red flags and it begins with a confessed killer named Randolph Franklin Dial. He confessed to murdering a karate instructor in 1981 in a murder for hire plot. And then he began his lifelong prison sentence in 1986 at the Oklahoma State Reformatory, which, fun fact, was the first male prison in the United States to ever appoint a female warden.
Wow.
And in 1927, no less.
That's a very big deal.
It's ahead
of their times.
It's a really big deal.
Oklahoma, the place known to be ahead of their time.
So this prison has a handful of maximum security inmates, but for the most part, this is a pretty relaxed medium security facility. The majority of inmates had a lot of freedom, and they were often involved in various classes and programs. Dial was a very talented artist and liked among prison officials. He was very intelligent and charismatic, and everybody enjoyed his company. So after years of good behavior, Dial was lowered to low security status as an inmate and put in charge of running the prison's newly developed art program, which is pretty crazy when you think about it because he was a convicted murderer.
Mm-hmm.
So like that just surprised me that anyone convicted of a violent crime could then at any point be considered low security, you know?
And they'd be teaching arts and crafts.
Right. So that's red flag number one. Anyways, the warden, a man named Jack Cowley, decided that Dial's art class would be taught out of the garage of a prison employee. The assistant deputy warden, a man named Randy Parker, lived in a single-family home on prison grounds with his wife Bobby and their two young daughters, who were aged 8 and 11. Bobby actually worked in the prison as well, and she taught a class for inmates with special needs, so she was comfortable on the grounds and interacting with inmates on a regular basis. However, she only interacted with them behind prison walls with, you know, plenty of guards present. So she wasn't exactly over the moon about the idea of a bunch of felons making arts and crafts out of her garage. But who was she to decide that these men posed a risk to her? I mean, lower security inmates are labeled that for a reason. And obviously there will be a couple of guards present. So Dial starts teaching the art class out of the Parker family garage. And the class was actually really good. Dial turned out to be a really great teacher. And there were inmates who had no interest in arts and crafts who wanted to do it just because it was like such a fun and interesting thing to do.
Yeah, of course.
Even Bobby herself became more and more comfortable joining in on the class. And then he even started teaching her pottery outside of regular class times, which is red flag number two.
It's very intimate.
It's very intimate. It's one thing for an inmate to be in charge of running a class. There's nothing unusual about that. But it's a whole other thing for that inmate to be allowed to give the deputy warden's wife private pottery lessons. And all I pictured was that pottery scene from the movie Ghost. And I'm sure that's not how their classes went.
Well,
I mean, no, because they're doing it in broad daylight in her driveway.
Look, intimacy can happen anytime, anywhere.
That's true.
I was immediately picturing him like spooning her with his like his chin on her shoulder and holding her
exactly
hands.
Like Patrick Swayze and Demi Moore. I know. So this arrangement where Dial is at the Parker home most days, operating the classroom and interacting with Bobby, this went on for quite a while. And eventually she realizes that security measures at the prison, they just weren't all that great. For example, Warden Cowley once granted Bobby permission to drive Dial into town for art supplies. Just the two of them. A convicted murderer in the midst of serving his life sentence was allowed to get into a car unshackled and run errands with the prison employee's wife. No guards in sight. So that's red flag number three. On the morning of Tuesday, August 30th, 1994, the Parker family had breakfast together before their daughters went off to school and Randy went off to work. When Randy left the house, Dial had already arrived to get the classroom prepped for the day. They said hello in passing, and then the two men just kind of carried on with their own business. A few hours later, Randy came home for lunch and found an empty house. Bobby had left a note for him on the counter stating that she went into town to run errands and she'd made a lunch for him that she left in the fridge. Randy said there was nothing unusual about this, so he just ate his lunch alone and then went back to work. Around 4:45 that afternoon, Randy got a call from his 11-year-old daughter who told him that when she and her sister got off the school bus, Bobby wasn't at home. Randy told her not to worry and reassured her that mom was just out running errands and she would probably be back anytime now. But when he got home from work about an hour later and Bobby still wasn't home, he finally realizes that something is very wrong. He starts calling friends and family and no one has heard from her. So he starts calling police stations and hospitals, but no one has any record of her. And then it hits him. When he came home for lunch, Dial wasn't in the classroom garage like he should have been. It hadn't even registered to Randy at the time, but this realization leaves him feeling like he knows in his gut that Dial is involved somehow. Randy immediately alerts the prison officials, who obviously rush to Dial's cell, only to find it empty. About the same time that the prison sounded the alarm for an escaped inmate, Bobby's mother, Clara, got a phone call from Bobby herself. All Bobby managed to say was, "I love you. Can you call Randy and tell him and the girls I love them too?" And then the line went dead. A massive search and investigation is underway immediately, and this becomes the most talked about case in the state. Bobby had been heavily involved in the community, always volunteering her time with any and all organizations who needed help. So she had a lot of friends, and the community rallied quickly to form search parties and fundraisers and hold vigils and all those things. Prior to this, Dial had been a pretty infamous criminal in Oklahoma because he was so charismatic and likable.
Yeah.
Despite the whole like murdering people for money thing. So when a well-known criminal like that not only escapes prison, but then kidnaps a deputy warden's wife in the process, it was salacious and news outlets featured the story pretty heavily. But regardless of how heavily covered this case was, there weren't any new leads being generated. And then 8 months later, on April 19th, 1995, the Oklahoma City bombing of a federal building took center stage in the media, and Bobby's case just sort of fell away from the public's focus. Her husband Randy told Dateline that while he refused to believe that Bobby was dead, he also couldn't help but hold his breath every time a new body was discovered. Once they confirmed that it wasn't Bobby, Randy went back to holding out hope that she was still out there and they'd be reunited one day. What he didn't know at the time was that their reunion wouldn't happen for another 10 years, 8 months, and 6 days.
Oh my God.
So now we're going to switch gears a bit and hear Bobby's side of things. And going into this, you have to know that the big question in this story is, was she kidnapped or did she leave willingly? So it's one of those stories.
Okay.
Bobby said that that morning, everything was normal. After Randy and the girls left for the day, she was busying herself around the house, and then suddenly she felt very woozy. She doesn't know how to describe it any other way. She started to fade in and out of consciousness and then remember seeing Dial standing over her. She remembers feeling confused and disoriented, and then she felt her legs give out from under her, and Dial caught her as she fell, and then everything went black. The next thing that she remembers is coming to as she was driving her car in an area she didn't recognize.
She was driving.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So she wakes up from the blackness.
Okay.
She claims to have no memory of getting in the car, starting it, backing out of the driveway, and then driving away. It's almost like she's describing it as though, like, she woke up in the middle of doing a task that she was doing, like, sleepwalking, you know?
Yes.
So red flag number 4.
Okay.
She said Dial was crouched down on the floor of the passenger side, and she began to panic. Dial told her to stop at a gas station so that he could get a first aid kit for her cuts. And that's when she looks down and realizes that her arms and legs are covered in very minor slash wounds. So she assumes that he has a knife on him and that he, like, was cutting her while she was unconscious or something. And so she does as she's told.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. There's going to be a lot of times where you go, okay.
Yeah, I hate when I don't believe someone.
I know.
It's a bad feeling.
Yeah. While they're at the gas station, Dial tells her she can use the payphone to make one phone call to her loved ones to let them know that she's okay. And instead of calling her husband, she calls her mom. So I don't know if that was like he told her you can't call your husband because he knew that, you know, obviously Randy would have the capacity to immediately track them down and the resources. And by then, of course, Dial has to know that the whole prison is, you know, sounding the alarms that he's missing. So Bobby, as she talks about this, she doesn't ever specify if she made the decision to only call her mom or if Dial was like standing there making sure she didn't call Randy. I don't know. So I don't know if it's considered a red flag, but it's worth noting, I think.
It's an orange flag.
It's an orange flag, yeah. Dial forced her to get back in the driver's seat and continue on. She realizes then that they're not even in Oklahoma anymore. They've crossed state lines and now they're in Texas. After driving for hours, they stop at a seedy motel in a tiny town she's never heard of. She said when they entered the hotel room, Dial hogtied her and beat her severely with a belt. He then pulled out a bag full of cash and showed her that he had a gun. She says she doesn't know how he got those things. He held the gun to her temple and told her that she needed to obey his every word, and if she tried to escape, he'd kill her family. He also told her that he had connections with the mob, which I think is the dumbest thing anybody can say. It's like the oldest line in the criminal's handbook. The people with real mob connections never admit to it. And then everyone who wants to be connected claims to be, but never actually is. So
it's a very good point.
Yeah, I know.
You're like, yes, it is, Anna. That's why I'm saying it. Acknowledge it.
Early the following day, Bobby said that Dial untied her. They abandoned her car and they took a bus to Houston. She said they stayed in a rundown apartment for several days, if not weeks, where she said Dial tied her up, beat her regularly, and would sexually assault her with inanimate objects. She said she was not permitted to leave the apartment, and Dial was the only face she saw for who knows how long. She said he did everything for her. He bathed her. He fed her. She wasn't allowed to do anything herself. She said they began to move from one trailer park to another, and over the course of a couple of years, Dial granted her more and more freedom. He needed her to work to help provide for their life, and so he found them jobs working together on an industrial chicken farm. He introduced he and Bobby as husband and wife, and they assumed new identities, Richard and Samantha Deal. The owner of this farm, a woman named Deborah Grace, was later interviewed for this Dateline episode, and she said that she did employ Richard and Samantha for a couple of years, and during that time, she had no doubt that they were married. She said there was nothing about either of them, together or separate, that struck her as anything less than a typical married couple. The only concerning thing she was aware of was that Richard was abusive towards his wife. Deborah remembers that he would openly say, quote, "She's my wife. I'll beat her if I want to." Deborah said that she made several attempts to save Samantha from her abusive marriage. She would intentionally create opportunities to talk to Samantha privately, but Samantha never accepted the help. Deborah even invited Samantha to move in with her several times and offered to help her get back on her feet, to which Samantha always said, "No, I can't do that. Richard wouldn't like it." Deborah and Richard eventually began to clash because the more she witnessed the abuse, the more she tried to intervene. So the couple quits their jobs and moves to another small Texas town, and that's the last Deborah heard of them. So obviously Dial and Bobby, who are still going by the names Richard and Samantha, so they move into a new trailer and she gets a new job on another industrial chicken farm. But he decides he doesn't want to work like that anymore, and he starts his own pottery business that he names Terracotta Gardens.
Oh my God.
He invested in radio and commercial ads in the local circuit. He was interviewed several times by local news outlets, and he's literally the face of the company. And he does pretty well for himself.
Oh my God. He had a gift.
Yeah, seriously though. So that just becomes their new life. They have new names. They present themselves as a married couple. And they're by no means keeping to themselves or like trying to fly under the radar. This goes on for a decade.
It's like they're almost in a real relationship.
It's almost like they're having a real life and relationship together. Bobby, she insists that Dial was horrific and that his wrath only became worse over time. She acknowledges that, yes, it's wild to hear that she had so much freedom that she literally was employed, but she says she was too fearful to disobey him. She said every day with him was torture, and the pain of being away from her children made her physically ache. But none of that was enough because she was too scared to run away or get help. She worried that because Dial knew where her children slept, he wouldn't hesitate to make good on his promise to kill them if she tried to escape. She said a few years into her alleged captivity, Dial got upset with her over something, and as punishment, he killed her two dogs, one of them right before her eyes. He told her that because she upset him, the dogs' deaths were her fault. She later said that some people just view animals as pets, but to her, they were always family. And I would assume that if she really was kidnapped, then her dogs were probably her only source of love and comfort. So experiencing that only confirmed she was right to be fearful of Dial. On the other hand, if she was with him willingly, I mean, that's just a sign of how unstable he is, you know?
Was it ever confirmed that the dogs were killed, or was this something that she just made up? Because I kind of feel like she's making a lot of stuff up. So I just wanted to make sure.
I actually don't know.
She just seems to be throwing out a lot of claims, and, you know, maybe she is telling the truth, but my gut's saying no. So I'm just wondering if that was just like a little, like a, you know what I mean? Liars do that. They just sprinkle on something else to back themselves up.
True. I mean, that's totally valid. And I genuinely don't know. That was just from her.
Okay.
So I can't really verify it. The dogs did exist because there's photos of, like, she had photos of them and stuff. So, but who knows? I don't actually know. Bobby says that in the 10 years with him, she fought for her life every day, and only once did she disobey him. She said in 2001, so that's 7 years into this ordeal, Dial woke her up in the middle of the night and told her, "I have someone on the phone who wants to speak to you. Just answer his questions, don't say anything else, and don't volunteer anything." It turns out the man on the phone was a retired police officer named Charles Sasser, who had written a true crime book on the life and crimes of Randolph Dial. Apparently, Dial had read the book, and like a classic narcissist, he just couldn't resist reaching out to the author himself.
I love your work.
Serious, for real, though. Like, that's literally what he was doing. So apparently that night, while Bobby was sleeping, Dial called Charles and told him that he and Bobby were happy. They were living together. They were living a country life, he called it, and that they were both making honest livings. Charles asked if Bobby was alive, and Dial told him, "Of course, she's in the other room. Do you want to talk to her?"
Oh my God.
So Bobby said when she realized who was on the phone, she couldn't resist the urge to ask, "Have you seen my children?" She said that she knew that Dial would beat her for asking, but it was worth it. She said when the phone call was over, She relished in the relief and comfort knowing that the FBI would be arriving anytime now. But then no one came. Days passed, then weeks, then months, then years. She assumed that this meant that Charles didn't go to the FBI, but it turned out he actually did. He'd immediately told the FBI about the phone call, but because he didn't know their location, there wasn't anything the authorities could do about it. So eventually, Bobby said, as devastated as she was, she just was sort of resigned to accept that this was her forever. She believed this was how she'd live out the rest of her days, being held captive and abused by a murderous psychopath, working on a chicken farm and missing her family more than she could describe. And then in early 2005, after an episode of America's Most Wanted featured Randolph Dial, authorities received a tip that he was living in Texas with a woman who may or may not be the missing Bobby Parker. On Monday, April 4th, 2005, a group of officers entered the trailer where Dial was living and arrested him without incident. While this was happening, another group of officers were arriving at an industrial chicken farm and approached the woman who went by the name Samantha Deal. As soon as she saw them, the first thing out of her mouth was, "Bobby Parker, my name is Bobby Parker." Later that day, when Randy Parker, who, by the way, was still working for Tulsa Department of Corrections, like her husband was still in that field. Yeah. When he got the call that his wife was alive and well and located in Texas, he immediately gets in the car and he drives through the night, not stopping even once. He said he didn't want to spend another moment away from her and he wanted to bring her home back to their girls where she belonged. Her daughters had been 8 and 11 when she last saw them, wow, and now they were in their 20s. Can you imagine that?
I cannot even imagine. You just missed out on everything.
Everything. And then for them, for her daughters, yeah, to like, it's unfathomable. Randy said that when they were reunited, he didn't ask her a single question, but he knew right away that a lot had changed. For example, she asked permission before doing anything. She asked permission to go to the bathroom, to go to bed, to eat, and so forth. In Randy's mind, his marriage never ended, and he was over the moon to have his family together again. And Bobby said that when she was waiting for Randy to arrive in Texas, she was spending hours and hours and hours wondering if her family would accept her back, if Randy would accept her back. But he made it very clear there was no question. He didn't need to accept her back because in his heart, she never left willingly. So Bobby is, quote, rescued, and is, of course, viewed and treated as a kidnapping victim. Police have no reason to believe otherwise, especially because as soon as he was arrested, Dial admitted to police that he had kidnapped her and held her against her will all this time. But like I said at the beginning, this whole story is full of red flags. And after Dial's arrest and Bobby's return home, police are shocked at just how many red flags are like flapping in their faces. It just keeps piling up more and more and more.
It's like flag day.
It's like flag day. Number one, when Bobby was rescued, she was allowed to call as many loved ones as she liked. And she called her mother, her sister-in-law, and her best friend. Her husband, Randy, did not make the cut. And then number two, Bobby initially refused to cooperate with police. She claimed that it was out of fear of Dial's wrath, despite knowing that he was already in protective custody. So that just struck the police as a little bit suspicious. And then number three, after taking Dial out of the trailer that he lived in with Bobby, police were surprised at the state of it. Looking around, it looked like a typical married couple lived there. For example, it was obvious that they shared a bed, and her nightstand was full of her items, including a vibrator.
Oh my God. Okay.
Police developed several rolls of film and found years and years worth of photos of Dial and Bobby living their lives, smiling and embracing and doing like all sorts of stuff. You know, the dogs were all in the pictures and things like that. They just looked like they were living a normal life. And other than finding a loaded pistol in the living room, which I don't think is that suspicious because they live in Texas.
I was going to say, it's Texas.
Yeah. There were no signs of Bobby having been held against her will. There was nothing that looked, you know, no torture chambers or like chains.
Restraints.
Or nothing like that at all. They also found numerous love letters and Valentine's Day cards that Dial and Bobby had written to each other over the years. But the biggest red flag came as they dive deeper and deeper into their investigation. Authorities were shocked to find out how often Bobby had easy, safe opportunities to seek help, yet didn't. For example, in 2004, so this is only 1 year before being reunited with her family, Dial had a severe heart attack and spent several days recovering in the hospital. Not only did Bobby stay by his side, literally and figuratively, but she also wrote him a lengthy, intimate love letter that she gave him after he recovered. So this dude was as incapacitated as one could be, but she sat with him every day, literally holding his hand through all of it. So when authorities questioned her on all of these red flags, she had an answer for everything. And to be fair, they're mostly plausible. Like, she believed he would kill her and or her family, so she never attempted to run away. She knew what he was capable of and feared involving other people, like, you know, that woman, Deborah, mm-hmm. who wanted to save her. She was really worried that if she took the woman's offer, then that put the woman, Deborah, in danger. And then after almost 11 years apart, Randy was not one of the first people that Bobby wanted to call because she said that she didn't know where they stood. Like, had he moved on? Did he believe she was kidnapped or did he think that she left willingly?
I don't think those are things that cross your mind when you've actually been kidnapped.
But then she also said that, like, she was told that he immediately got in the car and was driving to her. So she just called her mom instead. But I don't get it. Anyways. And then when it came to the heart attack, Bobby says that every day that she spent with that man was a day she had to fight for her life. And that included the time he was in a hospital bed. In her mind, she was never truly safe from him as long as he was alive. She says he had spent a decade convincing her that if she gave someone even the slightest impression that she was not with him by choice, he would make sure that she, her children, and her husband all died. And Bobby said that her intuition and her survival instincts all told her to take his threats seriously. She also stated that she did not love him or feel affection for him. So the letter she wrote to him during his recovery was meant to appease him. She also stated that the vibrator found in her nightstand was not hers, but rather a device that Dial used to assault her with. So through a really big investigation, detectives come to the conclusion that we're never really going to know what their dynamic was. They are convinced that it went beyond the textbook captor-captive dynamic. There was a level of fondness between them that bordered on possible love, but Bobby and Dial both aggressively denied this. Bobby has maintained all along she was a victim of kidnapping, abuse, assault, and severe manipulation, and Dial has always backed up her story. He told authorities and any reporter who would listen that he took her against her will and held her hostage. He insisted she was completely innocent of playing any role in his escape and that he forcefully kept her compliant with violence and threats to her children. So, of course, Dial goes back to prison immediately where he spends the rest of his life, and Bobby returns to her old life and begins healing and rebuilding. But then in 2008, so this is 3 years after her rescue, federal charges are filed against Bobby and she's charged with assisting in Dial's escape from prison in 1994. And if she was convicted, she would face 10 years in prison. She refused to accept a plea deal, so the case goes to trial. The state argued that Bobby had fallen in love with an inmate and helped him escape so that they could build a life together. And then some of their witnesses were pretty compelling. One witness turned out to be an inmate who claimed that he and Bobby had had an affair while she taught a class at the prison years before meeting Dial. And then another witness, an inmate who claimed that on the morning of Dial's escape, he was outside and saw Bobby happily, calmly, and most importantly, consciously, driving away from her home. He even said that as she passed him, they made eye contact and nothing seemed out of the ordinary. Nothing to give him the impression that she was drugged and had a convicted felon crouching down on the floorboards. However, it was later proven that the inmate who claimed he saw her driving away that morning changed his story so many times that he was no longer considered a credible witness. And the inmate who claimed to have had an affair with Bobby years before Dial came along, he turned out to have an untreated mental illness and had fabricated the whole story. But the biggest, most shocking discovery that the defense made was that Jack Cowley, the prison warden at the time of Dial's escape, had quite a bit to answer to. Prior to his escape, Dial was the subject of a psych evaluation at the prison, which stated that Dial was dangerous with an extreme talent for manipulation, particularly with women. It stated that Dial should under no circumstances be allowed around women, but specifically he shouldn't be allowed to create art around women because that was his go-to manipulation tactic when he was conducting the new scheme. Warden Cowley knew all of this, and yet he was the one who decided to implement a new art program. He was the one who decided it would take place every day in the Parker family garage. He was the one who decided that out of everyone, Dial would be downgraded to low security level and put in charge of running the program. The Parkers were not aware of the psych evaluation, and so they naively trusted that Warden Cowley had done his due diligence and would not have suggested this arrangement unless it was safe to do so. And we also learned that twice in the almost 11 years that Dial and Bobby were missing, Warden Cowley was informed of their precise location, the names they were using, and he personally verified both leads were true. He freely admits to all of this. He stated that because he verified they were making an honest living, he was content to leave them be. He chose to withhold this information from the FBI. He does not believe that Bobby was held against her will. Therefore, he does not believe that he failed to rescue her. He stated that he always believed Bobby left willingly because he remembered one time driving by the Parker family home and seeing Bobby and Dial on the front porch drinking coffee and looking too comfortable with one another. And I'm like, you're the freaking warden of the prison. Like, if you see this, why would you not do something? But I guess he was also the dude who put them all in this situation.
Exactly.
Anyway, so.
He's the one that did it.
Yeah. Despite all of this, Bobby is found guilty and she's sentenced to 1 year in prison. Her family was devastated and Bobby was heartbroken and disappointed, but she knew that she could survive her sentence. She said that she was held against her will for over a decade, so 1 year was nothing. She's since served her time and returned to her life now. And it's really important to note, I think, that everyone who was close to Bobby, whether it be her family or her friends, they have all stated from the very beginning that they believe she was kidnapped. Even when she was found guilty of helping Dial escape, they all stuck by her side and insisted she never would have willingly left her children for over 10 years. Randolph Dial died in prison from lung cancer in 2007, and Bobby is still happily married to her husband, Randy. He told Dateline that whether anyone believes Bobby's story or not isn't his focus. He said he believes it was real to her, so he will always be supportive.
Wow.
He said it's easy for others to be sitting in a safe environment as they hear Bobby's story and cast judgment. But ultimately, he believes her and he believes in the strength of their marriage. He said it survived being apart for over a decade. It survived her trial and her prison sentence. So there's just nothing left to test them. And that is the wild story of Bobby Parker and Randolph Dial. Do you think that she was kidnapped or do you think that she had fallen in love with an inmate and then left him willingly?
I think she fell in love with him for sure. But I feel bad at the end where he's like, oh, we're so strong and I love her and I believe her. Immediately was like, damn it. Well, that's all that matters. All that matters is what he believes.
Yeah.
But with that being said, I also don't believe her story.
Yeah.
I think I'm not negating the fact that she was probably abused.
Oh, for
you know,
sure.
I mean, she's with a murderer,
yeah.
You know, I, which is horrible and no one deserves that. So I think that she did run away willingly, but I think she probably did endure a horrible time.
I think what I believe is like, it's really hard because I feel awful because what if I'm wrong? What if she's actually victimized? So I wonder if it was more like, was she severely manipulated into it? I don't know.
The only thing is I don't like her story. Like, I don't like the driving away unconscious. I don't like, there's multiple elements to it, yeah. Where I'm thinking, okay, if this was actually a legit kidnapping, that's not how that would have gone.
Yeah. And, you know, there's no law that says if you are the victim of any horrible crime and certainly if you survive it, there's no law that says that you have to spill every gory detail to the public.
No.
Some people do, and that's their decision. And she hasn't really done that. That doesn't mean that there isn't way more to the story or
whatever
things that she's not
heal.
Sharing. So it's possible that there is a lot more that just isn't publicly known.
Of course.
And it's possible that there isn't. And
whenever I have an opinion or a strong opinion about something, I immediately feel really bad for having that opinion. And the off chance that woman is fully a victim.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Damn
I mean,
it.
It's just, I didn't say that to make you feel bad.
Yeah. No, I know you did. I'm just saying my gut tells me one thing, but what if my gut was wrong and then I'm a big A word?
You're a big A word.
Yeah. I'll have to live with that. I guess.
Feel like it's a little bit of everything.
Maybe a little bit of both.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was really, really, really well done.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for telling me that story.
You're very welcome. And thank you for sitting and listening.
Anytime. I'll do it tomorrow and the next day and the next day and the next day if you'll have me.
And then for weeks and weeks after that, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
I will have you. I will have you here to do that.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, I love you.
Pleasure doing business with you. Love you. Bye.
Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you enjoy listening. We owe everything to the many journalists, authors, filmmakers, psychiatrists, and psychologists whose extensive work and expertise we pulled from to share this episode with you. To view detailed source material, as well as content from today, please visit us on Instagram and TikTok at Shorty's Podcast. We really love doing this show, and if you'd like to help with the continued creation of it, you can support by donating to our Patreon, patreon.com/Shorty's Podcast. This episode was hosted by Ashley Brumley Johnson and Anna Katharina.